You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm back!
And you're back who? It's Ben who's back!
Ben didn't have to work tonight.
Well, that's good. You don't call this work?
I didn't have to work at my paying job.
I see. See, you're supposed to say no. This is a pleasure. See, you got to work on that fast, save like.
What are we talking about tonight? And how can I equate that with pleasure?
Because we are talking about The Man from Atlantis tonight, and this is, well, I've promised, and I'll probably deliver on this one. This will be the last episode that we talk about on Man from Atlantis.
Because it can't get any worse than this.
I have to admit, I did promise, and I don't really feel like plowing on through any more episodes of Man from Atlantis, but I just feel like that there might be a couple of little pieces of episodes here and there that should be, you know, maybe a wrap-up episode or something, but we can think about that after we've had a nice long rest. But we are talking
this nightmare.
This nightmare that is Man from Atlantis. But tonight we are going to be talking about The Imp, which is an episode which, if you follow our Twitter feed or have heard us in the past, I have described it as what I think the worst piece of television ever committed to film or tape. And every time I watch it, I can only bring myself to watch it by saying to myself, oh, it's not gonna be that bad.
What?
And then I watch it again, and it is
that bad.
It's every bit as bad as I claimed it to be in the first place. It truly is dreadful. I'm not even gonna start off with the whole did you like this episode, Ben? Because we didn't.
No, I hated this episode.
So I think I'm just going to try to describe the episode to you, just, you know, in short detail, not a hugely long process, but secret undersea water base, military, something's out in the water, it comes up the ladder, it's Arnold from Happy Days. Pat Morita, and he acts like an imbecile, and whenever he touches someone, they act like an imbecile. Most of the crew kill themselves. The last remaining one calls out, and they send Mark Harris because he's the only one that could ever get that deep, which we get some talks about. They bring him back. He seems to have the mind of a 6-year-old. Pat Morita hides, and then he shows up, and anyone he touches gets stupid and breaks things and causes problems, and before it's all over, he's threatening the existence of life on this planet as we know it,
and it's all for fun.
And it sounds so much better in my description than
it
actually is. Oh, where do you start? So we talked a little bit about in the episode C.W. Hyde, how I just really couldn't figure out who the episode was aimed at, because you had the whole the ridiculous premise and the childlike execution, and yet at the same time you had sort of themes of addiction and prostitution and other stuff that just didn't really fit with a kid-like program. But here we have a program where Pat Morita is acting like, and I'm going to try to do this, and I don't know that I can, but, oh boy, isn't this wonderful? I'm having so much fun.
That is
freakishly good, isn't
that,
it?
That is really good.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
Whenever he touches somebody, they go into, and they don't go into childhood state. I mean, that's what they want you to believe. What they go into is a stupid adult acting like a stupid kid. Oh, I want to play ball. Not if I see you first. That kind of stuff. It is really awful. And then my voice gets stuck like this, and I can't get out of it. Like, God, help me.
If I were on the other side of the screen, I would be slapping you right there.
I just almost lost it again there for a second. So he goes onto the base, and the first three sailors that he touches, they're all having fun, and they decide to go for a swim. And so
this is a deep sea lab, or at least so we are told.
And they just go right out the moon pool and die.
Yeah.
So, again, we have this whole, it seems to be aimed at children. And yet, the opening minutes, we've killed three men. It's kind of...
It's a little dark.
It's a little dark, yes. The base commander, who is Jaime the Control Robot.
Dick Gaudier.
Dick Gaudier. And Dick Gaudier is playing the base commander, whose name I can't even remember now. Jaime. We'll just call him Jaime.
Somebody named Sheffield.
Sheffield. Yeah, it's his first name that they keep referring to, though, because Pat Morita obviously calls everybody by their first name.
Right.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
We should point out what Pat Morita's name is in this. Moby.
Oh, yes, it's Moby.
And he refers to himself in the third person many times, too.
Yes. So, Mark Harris swims out to this base because only he can go to these depths. And these guys, by the way, had only been under there for 3 days, and the Navy thinks they've gone isolation crazy at deep sea depths or depths. But of course they spend that kind of time in submarines, so that's not really much of a test.
No.
But Mark swims in, and Dick Gaudier's character comes out, pretends to be jealous of his relationship with Elizabeth, holds a gun on him, and then shoots some flowers at him. And this is the first of my questions on this program. Why would a deep sea military base have a joke gun?
Have a joke gun? Yeah. Where would he get that?
Why would he bring a joke gun?
I don't think that's standard equipment.
Nor are the explosives that he planted in the locker.
No.
Not like bomb explosives, but you know,
joke explosives.
On the locker, so that when he convinces Mark to go get the locker, Mark opens it and it booms, and we all had fun. And so Mark.
Yes, they must have a supply of gags.
Yes.
Gag gifts from some sort of joke store.
Which, you know, the hours must have just flown by when that deep sea base, if that's all they had for their entertainment. And of course, here's the other problem. He slaps an air tank and a mask on him, and he swims him back over to the...
No pressure suit. And they're supposed to be in really deep waters.
Yeah,
I saw that. Okay, sure.
But, you know, it's just another one of those things that just doesn't make any... didn't make any sense in the...
There's a laundry list of things that don't make sense in this episode.
They kind of imply that the base is back in... Pasadena?
Yeah.
Which,
okay.
My
whatever.
California geography is not great, but as I recall, Pasadena is landlocked.
It is. It's not exactly right by the water.
So.
And yet this episode was, I mean, they filmed it in, I assume they filmed it in Hollywood, so you'd think that somebody there would have some basic sense of geography and say, you know, we may not want to say Pasadena, but...
He was talking about Pasadena as the place where he came from, but you kind of would think the military. I mean, it doesn't really matter. We're nitpicking on something that's ridiculously.
Because it's far more entertaining than the actual content of the episode.
True, so true. They get back to the base, and as they get further away from the base, the military guy gets more and more lucid, and he begins to kind of remember. You know, did I kill my men and things like that? But when they get back to the base, Just as soon as they arrive, suddenly he goes crazy again. And then we see Moby pop up at the Cetacean Institute, and he proceeds to run over to a very sophisticated piece of computer equipment, flip three switches, and it explodes.
Blows up!
Which, as I'm sure many people that I deal with in the tech support capacity on computers probably believe that if they push the wrong button on the keyboard, it will explode in a shower of sparks. But it won't, actually, people. It's very hard to do that, and certainly not this. But he does that, blows up the equipment, runs around and touches everybody. Everybody starts having fun. But and here's the interesting part. Mark then wants to shake his hands.
Yeah.
And he won't. He shies away. He says, oh, no, you're one of the down below people, not you, not you.
Okay. Yeah, that kind of bugged me a bit.
It did. It bugged me for a variety of reasons, because Mark never makes the slightest effort to learn anything about the down below people.
No.
From this guy.
And that's what that was probably my biggest complaint. I mean, when this whole thing began,
that was your biggest complaint. Okay, no.
Well, regarding this particular issue, when this whole series began, I mean, we're presented, or at least Elizabeth is presented, and through her to us, this whole mystery about Mark. For the first time, we are now meeting someone who has gills, who clearly has origins from under the, you know, in the ocean. And in the course of this series since it began, how many water breathers have we met? And now we've got Moby here, who says, oh, you're one of them. And I'm not going to do the imitation. You can't pay me. You're one of them down below people. A quarter. Right.
A shiny quarter.
I'll let you do that. He, again, Moby refers to him as the down below people. So now we're finding out in just such a short period of time since the show began. Oh yeah, apparently there's a whole colony of
Mark Harris,
water breathing humanoids or whatever you want to call them, and yet there's no pursuing this whole new revelation of Moby. I mean, and who the hell's Moby anyway?
Yeah, what is he? Yeah, we
know that he's an imp of sorts, but the way he's even introduced to us is bizarre. He just comes up through it's not an airlock. What did you call it?
Moon pool.
A moon pool, that's that. Comes up through the moon pool with a really weird-looking suit, and we're just supposed to accept him on face value as this thing who comes from. I mean, this is worse than Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
And hey, I like Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And it was, and he's
I
never
said it was worse.
Been to the surface world.
Apparently not.
Yet he speaks English.
Yeah,
it's just a thought. In fact, he speaks it all. At least Mark Harris had to learn.
That's back when the show was
sort of
had potential.
Back when it hadn't just gone straight to the horse's dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Moby escapes, and because Elizabeth, CW, and the generic technician guy are all infected also. Moby and Jaime escape, and how do they do it? He tosses a handful of marbles.
Oh yeah, and now
on
we have
the floor.
We have this whole Keystone Cop thing going on. It's pratfalls all over the
and
place.
Literally, this is one of those cases where you would expect it from a Scooby-Doo cartoon, where somebody throws marbles, and people who are standing perfectly flat-footed on the floor suddenly slip up, feet to the air, and fall flat on their backsides. Just because he flings marbles at their feet, which I'm going to ask, where did he get the marbles?
From the same place that they had that funny gun.
Yes.
And the explosives for the locker. Same place.
which you could sort of maybe make a case that Moby had with him, but then, of course, he would know human technology, like in the form of a gun and marbles and things, and so that would not fit with him not knowing the outside world.
No.
And it would also not fit with later revelations in this episode. And when I say revelations, I really don't mean that word. I mean, I don't know what I mean. So he goes out, and CW and Elizabeth start to recover, although they had fun. Did you see the look on Mark's face when he fell flat on his ass? Kind of stuff. I don't think they used that word, but but fell flat on his backside, and it was so hysterical. And so they try to... when he took the new car. And by the way, Mark learned to
drive
a car.
Mark's driving now.
Mark learned to drive a car in this episode, which I think in a couple of ways is this is a side note, but again, it's more interesting than the main story. One, he's just now learning to drive a car, but he's been piloting the sub
all this
along,
time,
which I'm thinking is probably a little more complicated than driving a car. But, you know, that's one. And two, he got a ticket for not using hand signal. And the part that's interesting about that is that we get this diatribe from Elizabeth about how he didn't need to use hand signals and cops are, you know, nobody uses hand signals and cops just had a big ticket book full of empty tickets that he needed to write. And it's really an odd sort of anti-establishment, anti-police rant on behalf of Elizabeth, which I can't help thinking that the writer had probably gotten a ticket earlier in the day when he was working on this episode, but I imagine the ticket he got was probably for driving under the influence of being brain dead. But we can talk
we'll get to
Mr. Shimon Winkleberg.
Yeah, we'll get to Shimon a little bit later. I've done my research on him.
Yes, barring further. Anyhow, so they deduce that they probably would have gone to a shopping village on the seafront. I forgot how they deduced that, but they deduced that they went there.
Because there's a crowd.
Could be. Anyway, Moby's down there. Jaime's down there. They go into, of all places, a novelty store.
Yeah.
And I mean a novelty store. I don't think I've ever seen a novelty store. We have Spencer's and things like that, but that's not the same. This is a novelty store like a store that sells whoopee cushions and exploding cigars. And
exploding guitars.
Exploding guitars. Well, you can see my opinion on smoking. And chompy teeth. And, I mean, all the stuff that used to be on the back of comic book covers.
Right. I haven't seen a store with that kind of gag.
To say a long time is something of an understatement.
You know, you can get some of them at places like Spencer's, but
I don't think you're going to find them at nothing. It's kind of this kind of like seaport shopping mall, whatever you want to call it.
No, how could you stay in business if that's all you sold? But anyway, they're in there and they're having fun, and then they get the guy, the owner. They transform him into a blithering idiot, too. You guys are crazy, is his line.
You know, and that's the other thing. Everybody's behavior, there's a lot of inconsistency with how people who are under the influence of Moby, how they all behave. Sheffield or Jaime, he behaves like some adult's idea of what a six-year-old is supposed to behave like, and that's completely inaccurate.
And an adult who's not around kids, obviously.
Right. When Elizabeth and CW are under the effect, they just laugh like crazy as if they're intoxicated. I kind of get the feeling that might have been the more accurate representation. And then he got this shop owner, and like you just said, he's like, you guys are crazy. It's like, okay, can we have – no, there's no consistency in terms of what Moby can do to these people.
Right.
So it's like, what the hell power does this guy have?
Anyway. after they do their little thing with that, they see a pirate ship, which is not really a pirate ship, but it's a sailing ship, and Moby dares Jaime to climb to the crow's nest and dive jump! Off, which he does. And Mark has to run to the rescue and pull him out of the water. And he's hurt. He's hurt bad.
Apparently he's hurt badly, even though it wasn't that high.
Well, I wouldn't want to make that dive.
Well, we're not trained for it.
Yeah. And he did try to make it look like a sloppy dive there at one point. He kind of...
Not very well done.
This man from Atlantis. While they do that, Moby escapes. And by the way, we also have a little discussion with Mark and Elizabeth, where Elizabeth talks about... You know, it's like, really, Mark, I don't know why you're all uptight about this. I mean, what's wrong with having a little fun once in a while? Remember that talk? Where they were walking along, and she's like, what's wrong with it? And he said, what if he is on a bus and touches the driver? Or is on a plane and comes in contact with a pilot? No, Elizabeth, people are going to be hurt.
I know. It's like these two extreme points of view. And the discussion was just stupid.
So Moby gets off, and we don't know where he is, so while Mark and Elizabeth take Jaime to the doctor. Although it was also interesting that when Mark pulled him out of the water, or Mark pushed him out, and a couple of bystanders pulled him out of the water, and they're all looking at him, going, I think he's hurt really badly, and Elizabeth is just up on the next level looking down, all worriedly. I'm thinking, you're a doctor, Elizabeth.
Yeah, do something.
Go down there. Don't just sit there. Again, it's very poor writing for poor Belinda J. Montgomery. They just really did not know what to do with her character. And you know, I don't blame her for disappearing off the show after this episode. Transpires that Moby has gone back to the Cetacean Institute and reinfected CW. And they come up with a very clever idea that Moby wants to play with more buttons. And so CW arranges to take him to the war room of the Pentagon, where he can play with a big red button all of my own. Quote, unquote.
That's exactly what he said.
And so they're heading off to the Pentagon to, as Elizabeth says it, set off every nuclear weapon and wipe out all life on this planet in 3 seconds flat.
There's nothing like a little bit of hyperbole there.
But fortunately, Mark is able to use the fact that it's the new car, and it's got a car phone, which looks more like a CB to me.
It's a CB radio.
And Mark calls him up, and... Now, for some reason, Mark plays a kid. I know a really fun place you can go. And then he won't tell him, no, you're not interested. And so Moby gets all excited, and I have to know. And he directs him to a place with a castle.
And a moat.
And a moat and lots of games.
Now, how does Moby understand a castle and moat?
Yes. Again, all of these things he doesn't... How does he understand a big red button of my own? I mean, he just doesn't get it. I mean, the good thing is that for all the threat that they have in this episode, there is no chance that they would have made it to the Pentagon. Because they already demonstrated he was going to go make the pilot his friend and see if they could fly the plane.
Yeah.
They would be dead.
Right.
Problem solved.
Although I'm kind of surprised that Moby didn't bother to try to drive the car.
Good point. Gosh, they didn't think this episode out at all.
No, they didn't.
So we find CW sitting in a fountain, fully dressed, eating an ice cream. And Mark chases down Moby and takes him to see Jaime in the hospital. And Jaime's all like, it's okay, Moby. I'm only a little hurt. It's all right. Don't feel bad.
And he's got this, it's okay. Don't feel bad. You know, like, oh,
what
God.
Is this happening to my eyes? What is happening, Mark? I don't understand. I want to go back.
And so Mark takes him back, and he goes into the water, and that's the end of the episode. Which again, Mark didn't even bother to ask him any questions. Do you know more people like me? Where can I find them? What are you? None of that.
Mm-mm.
You know, you're just too dangerous. You've got to go back into the water. Well, Mark could have gone into the water with him and talked to him there when he was safe around other people.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. A truly awful bit of time. I mean, it just, the directing was terrible. The acting was appalling. That somebody would let these people, these actors,
actually do this.
To do the behave the way they behaved, pretending to be kids, and not look at them and say, "That's the worst kid acting I've ever seen in my life. Do mm-hmm. it again." None of that. Just
no quality control. What really bothered me, as we've clearly established, this episode was bad. I mean, it's bad,
staggeringly bad.
It's beyond just being stupid. Now, if I see a stupid or a bad episode, and for me, stupid and bad, I come up with Naked Montague. That was stupid. That was bad. It made me angry. This episode was beyond that. This episode,
whole another level.
This episode did? It made me sad. It made me sad to watch these actors have to behave in this god awful yes. way. It depressed me to watch it. This is a whole new depth of atrocity.
It is. It's kind of like, you hear about people that are forced to, you know, like they have serious drug habits and they're forced to perform horrible acts of prostitution and self-degradation to get their little money, which they then turn over for a fix of drugs that's destroying their lives. And I feel for those people. I feel sorrow for those people. And I feel the same way for the actors in this episode.
Yeah.
It's like, I know it's a paycheck, and I suppose it was an honest paycheck. And you have to do what you have to do to put money on the table to feed your children. But not this!
I would sit there, I was sitting watching this, and I literally had my hand over my eyes, and every once in a while I'd peek through them, just because it was so painful to watch. I mean, this episode was so god-awful bad that it couldn't even raise itself to the level where it would then insult my intelligence. I mean, this was, without question, American television's worst hour ever.
It really is. It's the worst thing I've ever seen, and it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine. You know, some people might talk about programs being worse because they're cheaper or they've got crummy sets or things. But this one just...
They haven't watched this.
No, this... It does. You could have spent $50 million on this thing and produced the finest big-budget film ever. But
and
if you'd allow this acting
and
this story, and it would still be the worst thing ever made, because this is just a tremendously bad story. And that's our segue to talk about Simon Winkelberg.
I did a little bit of research.
Good old Mr. S. Bar David.
S. Bar David, yes. What has this man written? Okay.
One of my favorite all-time Star Trek episodes, the Galileo 7.
The Galileo 7. And he did Dagger of the Mind, which was...
Not one of my favorites, but...
But it's still a... It's not a bad... I mean, it's a little slow, but it's not bad.
Remember the Christmas party? You came in to clean up?
He wrote the first six episodes of Lost in Space, including the
unaired
pilot,
which was good.
Which was actually good, yes, it was. He also wrote the unaired pilot for Time Tunnel under the name of S. Bar David. He wrote two episodes of Wild Wild West.
Two mediocre episodes of Wild Wild West. Night of the Samurai and Night of the Inferno, I believe. Both of which.
Night of the Infernal Machine.
Infernal Machine. Right, and Night of the Samurai is the other one.
He wrote for Mannix, Medical Center, Gunsmoke, but the pièce de résistance
the
is...
The new one. New show. Law and Order.
Oh, did he?
One episode of Law and Order.
Oh, I didn't catch...
Which got translated into... One episode of Law and Order UK because they just reused the stories.
Oh, they reused it. Yeah. So. Well, the one capper to all of this is he does have a credit, and it's an episode that we talked about.
Starloft. Yeah. And Only Man is Vile.
That's right.
Yes.
And for our listeners, you guys know how we thought of that.
That's right. That's right. It was he had a Starloft. Yeah, he had so much stuff. He was a really jobbing writer, and I've seen quite a few episodes, not Star Lost notwithstanding, of his work, and it's not crap.
Not all of it, and as you, and
I mean, obviously this is. And
I mean, that's right. Galileo
so
7
what was he doing?
Is actually a Galileo 7. You know, that's a strong episode, and some of the first few episodes of Lost in Space, Dr. Smith notwithstanding,
was really good.
Were actually quite good, and I've seen the unaired pilot, and it was pretty good. I mean, 60 sci-fi television, but still pretty solid. And I think most people, most Lost in Space fans, would say that the first 6 to 10 episodes of the first year were the series' best.
Oh,
so he didn't write all garbage, and yet here we are presented with. As I said earlier, America Television's worst hour ever.
I have a question or a theory or a hypothesis or what you want to put it for, that he did this on purpose. That he made this bad on purpose. Nobody could write this story.
Trying to make something good?
Yeah. I mean, it's got so many things on it that just seem like it's a deliberate attempt to sabotage.
It's a good question.
You know, did he have a contract? You know, did he pull like a Tim Burton or something where he had a contract to make a Superman movie and he didn't want to do it, and so he kept coming up with stuff that was so awful that the producers finally just said, you know, we'll pay you and let you go on your way. We aren't going to do it. You know, that whole Nicolas Cage thing with that he was talking about, or something like that. So maybe he had this contract. He was forced to work for these people, and you know, maybe they held his children in slavery
or
something.
Maybe he was maybe there was talk about giving him a show that he could be head writer on, and then NBC burned him.
And so he wrote this thinking.
So he wrote a piece of garbage.
You know, I would think that you would put this script together. And say, hey, they paid me to write a script. Here's the script. You can't.
Let's see how stupid the NBC executives really are.
They have to pay me because that's the rules. I turn in a script, you have to pay me.
They'll never film it.
I get first right of rewrite.
And instead, you have to pay me again. Right out, yeah, and instead, they buy it right out and then air it.
And air it like it was. It's got to be.
Nobody could write. You know, given the things that we've seen him write, nobody could put together this kind of story and do it with the intention of writing something of quality.
Unless he was drug-addled.
It's not possible. Unless the guy just mysteriously had a stroke and
they didn't realize
and lost his mind.
And didn't.
But as you pointed out, he wrote for Law and Order. So
yeah,
I mean, he clearly had his. Writing capabilities, I mean, they were intact. This could only be deliberately done, especially when we've discussed the various details or some of the inconsistencies. I mean, as you pointed out, this was an episode that was not thought out.
My other possibility is, I think we've probably touched on this with regards to perhaps other shows like Doctor Who or something, which are primarily children's shows, and you can write a children's program and not write it for kids.
Well,
in other words, you know, you write it in such a way that
it's for the it can bridge several age groups.
But we know that the first thing that goes wrong when somebody frequently is asked to write for kids shows is they write down to kids.
Right.
Instead and so of, perhaps the remit was, you know, we need to get the kids watching. So make this a kid-friendly episode.
Was this series intended as a kid show? I don't remember it running at that kind of time slot.
No, I don't remember it running at that kind of time slot, but that could have been there. Could have been their contingency
plan. I kind of get a feeling
plan.
That it was their prime time.
You know, try prime to get the kid feeling. Show kids will watch and the parents have to watch with because there's only one TV in the house kind of thing. I don't.
There were only three networks.
So I don't know. I think it's lost in time as to
yeah,
what.
Yeah, I think this is going to be one of those questions that we're never going to get answered.
Particularly since the guy's dead. And I can't find any.
I couldn't find anything else about this episode, how it came to be, none of that.
Yeah, I think. Whatever
secrets Mr. Winselberg had, he took them with him to the grave. So we're never going to know why this episode exists in the way that it does.
This episode was fantastic until they rewrote it. I originally intended Arnold Schwarzenegger to be playing the part of the imp. And then they hired that Pat Morita guy. And I just... And he had such great comic genius, they decided to go over the top with it. Like, I
can say, oh, I got weird big red button to push on myself.
So, Man from Atlantis, Imp, is...
This episode really, I mean, even though we've described it and we've talked about it, it defies analysis.
It's a train wreck wrapped in a bus crash, hit by a plane while a meteor is striking the planet.
Covered by a big stinking pile of poo.
Look how you said that. Poo. This is a pile of poo.
Well, I was trying to emphasize the poo.
That's very Richard Hammond. So, we save that for last. Man from Atlantis.
May it rest in peace.
The worst thing. I would almost go out and say, look, find the imp.
You have to watch it. Because nobody would believe television could be this awful.
No.
Yet it is.
No, you really have to see this one to believe it. It's beyond the pale. It's bad. You know, if you only ever watch one episode of Man from Atlantis, watch The Imp. You'll never have the slightest desire to watch any of the other episodes of Man from Atlantis. And you'll be cured if you're one of those people who looks back on Man from Atlantis and says, you know, that wasn't such a bad show.
It wasn't that bad. Oh, really? Watch this episode. You'll be reminded about how bad it is.
Yeah. So we're going to leave it at that and say it's bad. Watch it. It's so bad you have to watch it. Watch it. Find it. Find it and watch it. But don't blame us.
Well, you know, they are releasing the series on DVD.
It is on DVD. And I... Time Lords help me. I'm tempted to get the DVD because...
It has to have bonus material. That's the only reason I would get it.
If it had bonus material, I... Because but it does have the episodes all digitally remastered, and I'd love to see them in decent shape because the copies I've seen are awful.
And we've discussed that we think that they've been hacked. I mean, we know that they've been edited or they've been recorded off of television.
And they've been cut up.
Clearly, yeah. They were recorded when the series went into syndication, and they were hacked terribly. So, out of curiosity. Some of the more puzzling ones might be interested to see.
They might make sense.
Yeah. Oh, God. There's a whole scene missing from The Imp that explains everything. We've been wrong all this time.
It turned out it was a great episode for that, just that one scene of emoting and I don't know.
No, we just find out that, you know, Mark Harris wakes up and he was in a shower.
I think he did that. I do believe he had that scene already. Next week, I have no idea what we're going to be doing next week. No clue. It's going to be a surprise. Our schedules have, as you may have guessed, been thrown off one way or the other. And so we're kind of trying to get back on schedule. It won't be Man from Atlantis.
Thank God.
There's that much I can tell you. If we do another Man from Atlantis episode, it will just be to go over a few...
Just some lingering
points.
Bits.
Lingering... You know, there's things like Elizabeth's strange disappearance in the next episode. There's some amusing stereotypes in one or two of the episodes that I want Ben's opinion on.
You know, I would not object to doing a wrap-up. I mean, just let you know, pick some key things that we can observe, and then, you know, and just do a final wrap-up and say, be gone with you.
Away with ye, away. All right. So, next time, I hope you'll join us again when we'll be talking about something better than this. Guaranteed. Mm-hmm. Good night.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.